This is the Yahoo Sports NBA Podcast, hosted by Chris Mannix. From interviews.
Let's bring in John Wall.
He's Reggie Miller.
Bring in Eric Spoelstra.
To the latest NBA news.
To insights you won't get anywhere else.
Rioting is bad. You shouldn't riot.
Past episodes of the podcast can be downloaded in the iTunes Store and Google Play.
Why wouldn't you go back?
Subscribe and leave a rating or comment. Here he is.
Speaking of guys putting their foot in the road.
Chris Mannix.
Yes.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Yahoo Sports NBA Podcast. Glad you could join me this week, and we have a great episode for you. Gary Washburn of the Boston Globe is my first guest, and Gary's been covering the Celtics for a long time. And the Celtics seemingly have a relatively clear path to the Eastern Conference Championship. They've got two lines of really good players, a starting five, potentially great players. Can anything derail this team? And what other team is the biggest threat to Boston the East? Again, do all that and more with Gary Washburn. A little bit later on, Elton Brand, the general manager of the Philadelphia 76ers. Elton has been on the job for just about a month. He's new to the job, only been an executive for a couple of years. What have his early experiences been like? What are the challenges for this Sixers team? We get into Markel Fultz. We get into the relationship between Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid. We get into a lot with Elton Brand of the Philadelphia 76ers. Quick housekeeping note, if you like this podcast, very easy way you can support it. Head over to Apple Podcasts, also known as iTunes, post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It's the best way to make sure we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, let's go. All right, joining me now on the podcast with the NBA season as we record just hours away, Gary Washburn does a great job covering the Celtics and the NBA for the Boston Globe. Gary, thanks for doing this, man.
Oh, good to be here, Chris.
All right, so you have to look for reasons not to believe that Boston's going to come out of the East. I mean, you've got everybody back healthy. Everybody seemingly happy. Marcus Smart got his money. Gordon Hayward has his legs back. Yeah, Brad Stevens is still the coach. I mean, tell me what the biggest question mark is to you with this team as we enter a year where they're going to be strong favorites, if not prohibitive favorites, to win the East.
That they struggle to learn how to play together, that the chemistry just isn't there when you integrate Hayward and Kyrie into an improved Tatum, and improved Brown. Rozier wants more of the pie. Marcus Morris. It seems, Chris, that everyone that I've talked to is on board with, like, winning. Like, guys know that it's not going to be like this next year. Morris is gone. Rozier's probably signing an offer sheet with another team. He's probably gone. Like, everyone knows this is a special year. You've got to take advantage of this because this is not going to happen again. And I think the mentality that I've seen from the guys is, like, no one's going to complain. No, like, hey, shut your trap. Put your ego at the door. Play your role. Under Brad, you know, if you play well, you're going to play more. He's going to put you in positions to succeed. So I think everybody understands that. They understand the talent. Like, Morris can't complain about playing time when he sees Jason Tatum dominating or Jaylen Brown. He can't say the guy in front of me is not as good as me. He knows that. The same with Rozier and Kyrie. You know, but the only concern is just the chemistry, and that maybe Gordon isn't the player he was before. But I think you give him 25, 30 games, and I think he'll kind of get back into that guy. He's not that guy right now. I think we can all see that. But you're right, Chris. It all seems kind of in line. Like, they've got the speed pass, no traffic, and NBA Finals looking above them. Like, you know, and maybe face Golden State.
So let me drill down a bit on Hayward. You've watched him through the Celtics preseason. Physically, he's healthy. Conditioning-wise, where his athleticism is, where is he in those aspects?
I think he's like 70% in terms of athleticism. He just seemed tentative. I mean, and obviously, we haven't seen him much in practice. It's only been the preseason games, and he didn't play in the last one in Cleveland, so you're talking about two or three game, you know, sample size. He just didn't seem real aggressive in attacking the basket, and he kind of settled. But then he made that chase down block against Charlotte, which I think was impressive. I mean, he's making little plays, flashes, and then the talk out of practice, since we don't get to see practice, is that he's improved, you know, exponentially over the last couple of weeks, his confidence, his athleticism. So, yeah, I think he's probably 70, 75% of the player he was. We're talking about Utah Hayward. right now, but I think that will change. I think, but you know, Brad's going to bring him along slowly, 20, 25 minutes a game, see what he can do, not blow his confidence, not give him too much right away. I think it'll be fine in, let's say, first of the year.
One of the questions that people have had about this team has come to from who starts, because presumably you have three wing players for two starting slots. In the preseason, one of the things that they've done to alleviate that is to start all five of their smallish guys and then bring in an Aaron Baines off the bench to be a more traditional lineup. That way everybody kind of gets their name called. But there are going to be some teams that that's not a great strategy. Philadelphia is an example of that, where you want Aaron Baines out there as much as possible. How do you think the starting situation shakes itself out all season?
I think they're going to have to mix and match. And I think they'll see in the first two games, you've got Embiid, and then I always butcher this guy's name, Valanciunas.
Valanciunas.
Yeah. I did it
close.
Again.
Close. Almost at it.
Those are the first two games. So they're going to face legitimate bigs in the first two games of the season. So it'll be interesting to see how Brad mixes and matches that, because you can't put Horford all for full time up against Embiid and the same against the guy in Toronto. So to me, they're going to have to mix and match. I mean, I think Baines is going to get his share of starts. I think they're just going to have to figure things out. I think a lot of it's going to be Gordon playing point forward in some ways and moving Kyrie to the two. I think that's going to be kind of a wrinkle that Brad throws in that people have pointed out to me that happened in the preseason. So I think Brad's going to mix and match. I think this is going to be, you know, a lot like, you know, other sports where you just, depending on the night, there's not going to be a set five. And I think the players have to understand that.
How surprised were you to see Kyrie Irving come out and say he's committed to Boston long term?
It was shocking, because you think that he would – I think the New York thing was really intriguing to him, you know, because now Brooklyn and New York have cap space, so either team can make him the max offer. He could try to be the king of New York. He can try to be Derek Jeter. But I think, one, he feels like he has unfinished business in Boston. Two, I think he's comfortable here. I think the organization, I think it's a lot like Kevin Garnett. The Celtics left Kevin Garnett alone off the floor. They let him do what he did. They didn't have many demands on him. They just said, show up to play, show up to practice, be a mentor. That's all we want. You know, we don't want you to be a man about town. We're not going to put a lot of demands on you off the floor. I think Kyrie likes the privacy. I think he likes the comfort here in Boston. He likes the appreciation. And he also, obviously, the talent around him is pretty amazing, considering you know, what he had when he first started in Cleveland, and then what he would see in Brooklyn and especially the Knicks, where he would be literally trying to carry them to a 40-win team or 45-win team. Like, it's not going to be the same if he goes to MSG. So I think he's just comfortable. And I also think, I mean, you know, because he's a quirky guy, so the entire kind of shutting us down from the questions during the offseason, and now saying, hey, I want to be here, that's Kyrie.
Do you think something changed in the last, you know, few months? Do you think he just didn't want to go through it? Do you think whether it was something he saw from the team in the preseason, do you think there was some kind of trigger? Or, as you said, is it just Kyrie? He's an odd dude that, you know, going back to his days in Cleveland, yeah, Everybody kind of knew that.
Yeah, I think that. And also, I mean, obviously the additional year and the additional money, $188 million, as opposed, I think, at $140 million is what other teams could offer him.
But he could have said all that in June. Like, yeah. Obviously, I'm not signing an extension. That would be stupid.
Yeah.
But I will sign. He never really
no.
– he kind of always left that door open for a few months.
He shut it down. He only wanted to talk about the movie. But I think that he was – I think he just kind of thought about it over the summer, and I think he's comfortable with his teammates. He knows, listen, Jalen's going to be here for a while. Gordon's here another two years at least. Al's coming back. Jason Tatum, his mentee, is going to be here. It's a comfortable situation. It's a chance to win maybe more than one title, you know, and it's that security and that comfort that, like, this is the place for you, and you could have your jersey raised, you know, in the rafters. I think that means a lot to him. Although, I'm a little surprised, Chris, because I thought maybe him going back to New York, as you know, remember when he listed his teams that he wanted to, you know, when he demanded a trade in Cleveland, the Knicks were on that list, and I don't think he would have minded Brooklyn either. So I think it's interesting that he kind of shut it down before this even began. Now, who knows? Will Scott Perry give him a call July 1st and say, have you reconsidered? Or will there be any intrigue come July 1st? Or will at midnight right away, will he ink his deal? That'll be interesting.
I've always said the magnetism of playing at home is real, whether it's attracted to or repelled from. Yeah. Remember, Kevin Durant wanted nothing to do with playing in Washington, D.C., whereas LeBron James and others have said, I want to play at home. I think it was more the LeBron type for Kyrie. I think he'd, all things being equal, he would like to play at home. He would like to be, you know, he's from Orange, New Jersey. He would like to play at Madison Square Garden. But fortunately for the Celtics, this is just my opinion on it, all things are not equal. They have a great team, whereas the Knicks, until proven otherwise, are a mess. So I think Boston's success probably had a big, big factor in all this.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you look at New York, and even if they bring in him and another free agent, Porzingis coming off an ACL, what do you do with Ntilikina and Moutier? They don't have the talent. You know, they're trying. They're rebooting, and they're in the right direction, but it's a long way away. Good coach in Fizdale, but the Knicks are, I mean, they're gonna struggle this year. I mean, without Porzingis and your best player is Tim Hardaway Jr., they're going to take it on the chin. And so you're talking about Kyrie coming to a situation where it's like him, Porzingis, a lottery pick, and okay, go out there and try to win 50 games. No, I mean, I think Kyrie wants to win. He wants to win now. He wants to win another championship without LeBron, without that shadow hovering over him of, well, LeBron got you that title. You just hit a jumper. I think he wants to do that, and I think he realizes that Boston's the best place for that.
How do you think the Celtics feel about him physically coming into this year? I mean, they can downplay the knee stuff all they want, but three knee surgeries in a couple of years is a real thing.
Yeah, and remember, I think the most games he's played in the season is 71.
2 years ago, right? I think the championship season, maybe?
Yeah, and take out the lockout year where he couldn't really play. He played, I think, 60 of the 66. You know, Kyrie's not an 82-game a year guy, a season guy. That's just not him. I you know, if you get 70 out of him, 72, 73, I think that's good. That's why you have Rozier. You know, that's why you signed Brad Wanamaker and you got Marcus Smart to play some point, too. So I don't think they're worried about that. I don't think they run him out there for 82, especially when it gets to March and April and you got you know, Orlando at home on a back-to-back or something. I don't think that happens. I think they – give him the rest he needs. They understand, okay, we don't want to wear him out. You know, unless he has some gung-ho goal to play 82 like LeBron did last year. Yeah, I think 70, 72, 73 games is very good for Kyrie. Give him a couple games off. Let him rest that knee. Let him be ready for the playoffs.
So you mentioned Rozier, and I didn't think the Celtics would trade Rozier until they knew Kyrie was going to be around long-term. With Kyrie saying what he says, do you think that changes their mindset? We know that Danny's never satisfied. He's always looking to make deals. And now you have Rozier. No surprise they didn't agree to a contract extension. I mean, why would he? He's going to be in line for $15-plus million, maybe a starting role somewhere else, no matter what happens this season. But do you expect the Celtics to try to keep this depth together? Or because Rozier is likely an ex-Celtic after the season, do you think they'll be proactive in that sense?
I don't know if they'll move him. I think that they'll... I mean, they can maybe work on a sign and trade or something like that if he does receive an offer sheet. I think there were teams that would be interested in him. He's young, he's eager, he's talented. He has a chance to be a very good player. I think he understands, and I think he's fine with the fact that I want to start and it's not going to be here, and I'm not going to make any noise about it. I'm just going to wait my turn. I think he's got some good advice, like Terry. Just, you know, don't complain at this point. You're basically backing up a future Hall of Famer. So wait your turn. You'll get your chance. Will Danny try to turn that into an asset in a return? Of course he will. You know, when that will it be during free agency? Will they try to work out a signing trade? I think that's something that they will think about. Will Danny try to bring him back? Will he dig into the pot of and risk, you know, the exorbitant luxury tax and try to bring him back for a short-term deal? Perhaps, you know, that's a possibility. And you have to remember, too, you know, they have the Kings picks. They have another lottery pick coming. So you've got another probably top 5 to 6 pick coming in whatever position you want. I mean, obviously it might not be Zion Williamson or something, but I don't know how deep this 2019 draft is. All I know, Chris, about the 2019 draft is the one and dones will be born in the year 2000. So just, you know, marinate on that for a while. Oh, my goodness. So, sorry, drifted. But if it's a deep draft, the Celtics are bringing another lottery pick or whatever position they want, whether they want another wing or they want a young point guard. So they can let Rozier go and draft essentially draft his replacement. That's the flexibility of having another lottery pick coming. I mean, that's it's an embarrassment of riches.
It's insane to me that they could have a top five. They could be in the finals and have a top five pick. I guess my question more is like, do they go all in on this year, knowing that they have a high degree of probability of getting to the finals, but not a high degree of probability of winning the finals? I mean, walk before you crawl, and I know the Celtics have played great against Golden State in the last few years, with Isaiah or Kyrie, but it's formidable to say you can go into a finals matchup with a young team against the two-time champs, which will have DeMarcus Cousins playing at that point. So I wonder, you know, one thing that, and I know it's not exactly the same circumstances, but when the Celtics traded Avery Bradley, they got a lesser player back in Marcus Morris, but one that had an extra year on his deal. So they were able to get somebody they really liked who wasn't the same player, at least on paper, as an Avery Bradley, but had extra years on his contract. Might they explore that with a Terry Rozier? Or do they look at Rozier as being so valuable to get to the Eastern, get to the NBA Finals this year that they don't want to deal it? I mean, look, anything can happen in February where situations present themselves, but that would be something I think I would watch. A guy being available who has extra years on his contract.
I agree. And the team that gets Rozier is a team that has every intention on re-signing him. So they have their point guard, and they give up, you know, let's say a guy with another year in his contract to dump. Yeah, I could definitely see Danny perhaps working on that. I mean, Danny's not going to rest in February. Danny, even though this team might be, 42-12 or whatever at the All-Star break, and Danny's not going to turn around and just kick it and look at the phone on trade deadline and not make a call. I mean, he's going to try to enhance and improve his roster and whichever way he feels best. And obviously the Rozier thing is interesting because I think we all know he's probably gone after this year. So is Marcus Morris. But, Marcus wants to get paid. Marcus is going to try to go somewhere and get, the $12, $13 million that Marcus Smart did. But with Rozier, I think it's an interesting situation because he's a guy you want to have on your roster. I think every team wants a guy, a bulldog guy like him, a guy who's hungry and talented and athletic. But with Kyrie coming back, I don't think it's happening.
In no way does it take away from Brad Stevens, but is this the first year where there are real expectations on him? I mean, last year they were kind of scuttled because of what happened with Hayward. Everything was a surprise. The year before that, oh my God, you get the top seed, but you get to that wasn't considered a championship team when they were the number one seed that year. Is this the first year, like, real expectations on Brad Stevens to coach this team, like, finals or bust?
Yeah, I'll say this, Chris. I think that in as much as Brad is considered a great coach, and as much as he is considered a top two or three coach, Pop, and if you want to throw Spoelstra or Doc in there, whoever you rank, there are coaches around the league that resent the attention he's received. Okay, hence the Coach of the Year vote where he didn't get a vote, the Coach Association vote where Dwayne Casey won. And there's coaches that like Brad. I mean, it's hard not to like Brad. Brad's the polite, he's humble. It's not anything personal that the attention that he's gotten as being a great coach. So there's a lot of people behind the scenes that are saying, okay, Brad, let's see what you do with a healthy team. You came with one game of the finals with that team, and you got a lot of credit for it. No excuses this year. And I think that, yes, Chris, there's a lot of pressure on Brad to get to the finals because they've been to two straight Eastern Conference finals, believe it or not, one with Isaiah, and then Isaiah got hurt, and then last year where they kind of blew game seven. So now if they don't get to the finals, it's a disappointing year. And I think the pressure is on Brad to coach these guys to get to that level, to beat the Torontos and the Milwaukees and the Indianas and Washingtons and Philadelphias to get there. So, yeah, because this is his sixth year, and this is his biggest year, most pressure, most expectations. And people and other NBA coaches are looking and seeing, okay, let's see what he does with real talent and healthy and no excuses, because last year he didn't pull, but people were, oh, well, they didn't have Kyrie and Gordon. What an amazing job by Brad. And I think, coaches around the league resent that. They don't resent Brad, but they resent the attention because they all know, every coach thinks he's a good coach, And so when Brad gets it and hasn't reached the finals, then there's some resentment there.
Lastly, the threats out there are somewhat of an unknown. I mean, Milwaukee, they're an unknown until we see what Budenholzer's system, how that fits with Giannis and that group. Toronto, Kawhi looks healthy. How does Nick Nurse fit into all that mix? Philadelphia opens the season against Boston. Markelle Fultz, can they survive without you know, with 40% of their starting lineup, they can't shoot threes consistently. But who's the biggest threat? If you asked the Celtics privately who they maybe fear the most, who would it be?
I think it would be Philadelphia and Toronto. But there's such, as you said, Chris, there's so much unknowns. How is Kawhi going to work into Toronto? Does Lowry still have it? I mean, he's 33 now. I mean, is he still the same player? Is Serge Ibaka, who I just can't believe is only 29. I mean, it's a tough 29 there. Does he have?
That remains to be seen.
We'll see.
Let's get that birth certificate out there.
Technically 29. Does he have something left? And to me, the team, I think, I mean, is Indiana. Indiana's a lot like the Celtics were a few years ago. Very even talent. You've got Oladipo, but you've got a lot of guys who play really hard, and they didn't lose anybody from that team. And you got an emerging player in Miles Turner. And then they add Tyreke Evans. They add McDermott. They add Kyle O'Quinn. So you got a team that plays hard. It doesn't get a lot of attention. Oladipo always plays with a chip on his shoulder. I think that's a team to look out for. I think the Celtics are looking at Philadelphia and Toronto, but I think they have to respect everybody. I think, you know, Washington, with Dwight, it's either going to be really good or really bad. There's nothing in between. That's going to implode, or it's going to be like, wow, Dwight, you really, you know, brought back the Wizards. The Wizards are either way, you know.
I can't see that.
I
can't see the wow, Dwight, you really brought back the Wizards conversation.
It's either goes either way. I'm leaning toward really bad, but you know, Washington still got talent with Wall and Beal. You know, Milwaukee, as you said, who knows what Bud I thought was an interesting hire. I don't know if it was the right hire. They still haven't addressed point guard. You still run Eric Bledsoe out there, who got kind of embarrassed by Terry Rozier in the playoffs last year. But I think there's a lot of competitors. Detroit might sneak up on someone. It's just, I think the East is kind of a minefield, and I think the Celtics have to realize, and I think they do realize, that anyone could jump up. There's going to be a surprise team. There's going to be an Indiana last year. There's going to be an Indiana this year. There's going to be a team that wins 47, 48 games that we thought might win 38. It all depends on who that is.
Should be interesting. Gary, always appreciate the time, man. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks. No problem.
All right, joining me now on the podcast, he's the general manager of the Philadelphia 76ers. He's Elton Brand. What's happening, Elton?
Oh, man, Chris, all is well. Busy, but enjoying life. How are you?
How's that feel still, the general manager of an NBA team?
You know, it's still somewhat surreal. You know, I've had a lot of time in the NBA, so to, you know, get to this level and this side, the business side of it all, it's a lot different.
I want to get into some of that, but, you know, you've been on the job a little under a month now officially. What's it been like?
It doesn't stop. There's something to do every day, something that feels really important to the organization, to the team, to the coaching staff, to families every single day. You know, I spoke to Rod Thorne and, you know, other great GMs. They're talking about putting out fires, and it's true. I'm a fireman now.
As you were entering kind of the twilight of your playing career, was this an aspiration? I mean, what were you thinking as you're in those final days in Atlanta and kind of realizing the end was coming? What were you thinking about?
Yeah, so I felt like I didn't want to work. I didn't want to work ever again. I'm just going to hang
with... We all feel that.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't want to, you know, leave the family because I left my kids so much, you know, my wife. I just was like, all right, I'll just be at home. You know, I took the kids to school every day. My wife and I picked them up. Teachers are saying it's rare that both mother and father pick up the kids. And I'm like, yeah, I don't have a job. You know what I mean? Like, that's just what it was. I didn't have a job. But before that, the Atlanta Hawks offered me the assistant GM job. And I kind of shadowed, was around it. I saw what it was. It piqued my interest, but I knew it's not 10 hours, it's not 12. You're on all the time. So I said, I'm not ready for that. I need some time away.
And, I mean, you want to be around your kids. You want to not work. But at some point, I mean, you're still a very young guy, professionally speaking. I mean, were you thinking broadcasting down the line? Because that's a cushy gig if you ask certain people.
So I got offered broadcasting also right out, and it paid well, and it was like, all right, you can do this many games.
4 hours a week, you know, first class flight, take your time.
Yep, take your time, grow into a role. It was college basketball, there was a little bit of pro stuff, and then a team actually said you could do the color. And that was a bigger check. And it was just like, I'm just not ready. I just can't commit right now. Because I knew the dedication, the hard work, anything you do at this stage in your life is going to be a lot of work. So I just wasn't ready.
Did this job and the possibility of it get your kind of competitive juices flowing a little bit? Because you weren't a slam dunk candidate for it right away. I mean, you had to compete for this job.
Absolutely. I was the underdog. You know, my G League staff, where they're calling me Cinderella. You know, people around the office is like, man, EB, he's, you know, 20-1 odds, but don't count out EB. So it absolutely did. It absolutely did. So when I got my PowerPoint ready and my meetings, like, I'm staying up all night, I'm studying, I'm putting together my vision. You know, so I was revved up. It did get the competitive juices. And the ironic part was I was competing against some of the guys that we were running the show for the last 5 months. So my analytic guy, Alex Rucker, was also interviewing for the job. So when I need analytics, and that's who I go to. You know, Ned has been with the NBA for, you know, I don't know, 12 years before he was with the, this side in management. It's like I had to have a question about the CBA. I'm like, Ned, just to be clear, you know, but he's interviewing for the job, Ned Cohen. So I'm like, okay, I need to do this with my group, but also I need to be my own individual and show how I would shine.
When you got the job, did you ask, you know, what was it about me that put me over the top?
I didn't ask, but I think, in my opinion, I was organization first. They told me that they had an opportunity to maybe get other prominent GMs. So I gave them an example of, if you could get X GM, you need to expend resources to get X GM. Like, forget about me. I might lose my job. My current job is VP of basketball ops. I understand. I don't want an extension as VP of basketball ops because I don't know who you're going to bring in. But if you could get that guy, you should get that guy. And I think that kind of set me apart, because they're like, all right, he doesn't actually need the job, and he will do what it takes for the organization to win. And I think that's what set me apart.
This was, you know, it's an interesting job. You know, on the surface, everybody says you got two star players, a former number one pick coming back. At the same time, rarely do you see new general managers in winning situations. This was a unique circumstance because of what happened last year. You know, you enter the job in what I would argue is the most difficult phase of it, you know, trying to take a team from good to great. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not easy to tear a team down, but it's easier to tear a team down and build it back up to a certain level. You've got that team, you inherit that team on that level, and you have to now take it to that next part.
Great point, Chris. So the expectations are much higher. You know, it's tear a team down and you know you're rebuilding and you have 5 years to implement your vision, and it doesn't work, you're out, like we see with so many GMs. Now, to get from good to great is a tough, because there's many tough decisions. You know, contracts are coming up, guys are want to get paid. So is this player worth this? Are we going to have to make moves before free agency? Like, it's a lot on my mind and on our mind, because we need to get there. And that's our ultimate goal, is to get a championship, get to that level.
Did you think about that before you kind of threw your hat in the ring for a job like this? Because, you know, if Philadelphia was interested in you, somebody else would be down the line. If you continued on that path, you would have had that offer. And, you know, some guys like the idea of, you know, ripping a team apart and building it back up again, giving themselves 4 or 5 years of latitude to rebuild a team.
Yeah, no, I took a huge risk. I was offered an extension 3 years. I don't know if I'm supposed to say that, but I was, as the VP of basketball. And I turned it down because I didn't know, if you're going to bring in a president or GM, we don't get along, I don't have an opportunity to grow. But when this opportunity came up to interview, I said, I need to take a chance. I need to go for it because of my group. My group should feel safe. If I get it, my group should feel safe. If Mark Eversley got it, we would feel safe. Alex Rucker got it. Ned Cohen, our group coach, you know, just this whole office that, you know, got us to this point. They need to feel safe. They should feel valued, and they should feel that they can grow. So I said, all right, I need to step up for us, not just myself. Myself, yeah, I'll take a 3-year window, get my own team, tear it down, build it up, no expectations, and ride off into the sunset. But you're right. It's a big risk for me, because this is it. You know, after however many years, it could be, all right, you're out of here.
One of the interesting parts about this job that I thought from afar was that it seemed like there was a desire to have it be a collaborative process with the front office. And that's great in theory, but the buck does have to stop somewhere. And, you know, when Brett Brown was elevated, and it's clear he still has, you know, a lot of influence with the team, you've got your staff there. How were you at all concerned that maybe the buck wouldn't stop with you when you took this job?
You know, I wasn't, because we are Coach Brown's staff. Like, people don't understand that. Like, there wasn't a separation. Like, you think Brett Brown is out scouting in L.A. when we're watching Zaire Smith and we're watching Mikal Bridges and these? No, this is our staff. We present it to him like we present it now to myself, or I don't know if that makes sense, but my group presents it to me. Like, we are this one and the same. Like, we were making those decisions together for the last 5 months, draft, free agency, all of that. So I knew where the buck would stop. So I didn't have any worries about that.
But with trades too, I mean, it's all on you, correct? That's
all on me. But as a coach, and Brett Brown, of course he has say in it, because if he says, look, EB, I'm not going to play that guy, and I can get the data and I can show and I can put my player hat on and say, coach, believe me, I know this guy can play. He'll make a difference. But at the end of the day, the coach has to implement our plan. He has to play the player. And he understands. He understands with the organization. He knows we're not championship level yet. You know, that's a goal, and we want to get there. So he wants to get better. Like, he's eager to get better.
Did you ever think when you came into the NBA you'd have such a rich history with Philadelphia? You know, 20 years, some years later, this would be the team that you're inextricably intertwined with, from the Philly Max to the Amnesty to coming back to here you are now?
Not at all. Not, you know, with the Clippers and that great run and, you know, that young team and, you know, the Bulls where I started with, you know, Jerry Reinsdorf and Jerry Krause. So, you know, now Philly, because as a player, you know, it didn't go as well as I expected with the injuries and coming off the Achilles and the torn labrum and stuff like that. So I definitely didn't think it would be here.
You mentioned kind of building this team into a championship contender. Do you believe right now, as we sit here on the eve of the start of the NBA season, that this team can organically grow into a contender, or does it need another move to get there?
So that's to be determined. You know, we're going to see, we're going to, you know, evaluate first 10, 15 game tranches and look at it. But, you know, just me and what I've seen in preseason, what I've seen in the summer, I like to be a realist and say, no, we have work to do. We have work to do.
What do you make of the, you know, just to get into the nitty gritty of this team, again, as we sit here talking in Boston before you open the start of the season, Markelle Fultz is going to start. JJ Redick's coming off the bench. Obviously, these are coaching decisions, but it's interesting. You're going to put two guys in Fultz and Ben Simmons that, you know, teams are going to challenge to be three-point shooters right off the bat. And I mean, I don't know about you, but I can count on probably one hand the number of teams that were successful without great three-point shooting consistently.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Having Markelle out there, you know, at the beginning has been, you know, questionable because we were the number one starting five during the season. But that didn't get us anywhere. That didn't get us to the Eastern Conference Finals. That definitely didn't get us to the championship. So we are trying to grow Markelle and our young players to the point that once it's time to get to the playoffs, they're developed enough to really help us. We don't want to go through that problem of winning 17 out of 18 and all the, you know, all the hype behind us and take another L. Like, that's our goal. But, you know, JJ's been great. Coach had him speak to Manu Ginobili and give him a message about how he came off the bench and how awkward it was at first. But it extended his career. It helped his legs. He still feels good, and he was still able to dominate games in spurts.
Going to bring Manu into the Sixer fold. I can't, you know, almost signed him a couple of years back.
Yeah, well, we tried. We threw a lot of big money on him. He passed.
You forced I think, San Antonio to do something they didn't want to do at that time. You watched what Markelle went through all last year as an executive with this team. You've watched what he's done in the preseason leading up to the season opener. Where is he, in your opinion? Do you think he's right mentally, physically? Where would you put him in those categories?
You know, I think he's close to where any 20-year-old number one pick's going to be. You're going to have your ups and downs. So it's us as a staff and coach. He's been great. He's going to stick with them through the ups and downs. But, you know, it's basically, he's a rookie. He played 10 games at the end, 4 games before that, 14 games. So any 20-year-old rookie is going to have ups and downs, especially with the pressure of winning now. No, when I was the number one pick, we knew we weren't going to win. Like, we didn't even care to win.
Not much. They didn't win much that year.
No, but we didn't even care. It's like, develop these guys, go make mistakes. You could have 4 or 5 turnovers in a game and not even blink. Like, you're trying to grow. You're trying to figure it out. We have pressure to win now. So any 20-year-old with that type of pressure, I think he's right there.
I saw him do an interview with Isaiah Thomas in the Players Tribune where he, you know, kind of opened up a little bit about what happened last year, talked about physically. He just wasn't right physically. There's been a lot of talk around him that maybe he wasn't right mentally, that the injury led to something else, which blended kind of together. To you, was it more physical than mental? Was it more mental than physical with him last year? Where do you divide it?
Yeah, so I didn't see that that interview or that article, but, you know, to me, if something's going on physically and I can't do what I know I can do, it's going to affect me mentally, for sure. That's just the way it is. And as I got older and I aged in the game and I had injuries and Achilles and shoulder, and I couldn't blow by to the basket and do my little reverse dunk that I used to love to do from the left block, like, I was affected. Like, I'm thinking, like, man, will I ever get it back? Will I ever be able to do the things that I used to be able to do? So, of course, yeah, I think it has to be some of both, in my opinion, from that aspect. Doing something physically that you could do and you excel at and not being able to do it. That's just human nature.
He was a, 41%+ three-point shooter in college. So it was there for him in college. Do you think he can get that back?
Oh, that's the goal. It was definitely there. And summer league, it was there. Like, I seen him. He went at Tatum. They played each other. I'm watching. And definitely, the goal is to get that back.
You think you think mentally he's over that? I mean, or is that something you have to monitor as the season goes on?
Yeah, no, we'll watch it as the season goes on. Try to grow him. Try to make sure he feels comfortable. We've provided all the whatever he needs. We provided it for him and all our players. So, yeah, so we have to monitor that for sure.
Is it a good thing that the season opens against Boston and against, not literally because he's not going to defend Jason Tatum, but because of the history and the way these guys are going to be linked kind of forever because of that trade?
Oh, it's a great thing. Like, just dump all the pressure and all the attention and, yeah, just dump it on him right now. Yeah, it's, you know, fate has a funny way of entering itself into your life. No, I mean, I'd rather let him play somebody else, get comfortable, get going, but that's the way this business works.
Your two star players, Ben and Joel, as you start thinking about their future together, what do you look at? Do you look at how they complement each other? I mean, obviously, maybe not obviously, I would imagine you'd want the two of them around as cornerstone players for a long time. For the podcast listeners, Elton's nodding his head affirmatively. How do you decide if they truly complement each other? What do you look for out there on the court?
You know, obviously, we do want them around for, you know, 10 years or more as our cornerstone players. So the way they complement each other on the court, but also off the court. You know, they don't have to be best buddies, but there's a mutual respect there. And that's what you need out of two emerging global superstars. Like, they're huge around the world, and they can really play on the court. So on the court, gelling, and off the court, being 1-2 and having a common goal of winning a championship, which they're working at, and I think they have it.
Do they have? How would you describe that relationship off the court? Because a lot of people will wonder: Are they close? Do they need to be close? What does that relationship have to be? And what do you think it is?
You know, as a GM, I'm not with them like dailies and dinners, but they're close enough. Like I said, they respect each other. They do go to events and hang out. Like, I don't anticipate any problems. I don't see any problems, and I think that's kind of just media fodder if there is anything. I haven't heard anything like that, but, you know, you've seen it with Shaq, Penny, Shaq, Kobe, you know, superstar young players, could have some dissension.
Have you had to force yourself as a GM to keep a distance? Because you were great with young players later in your career. You were quite literally brought in to mentor young players later in your playing career. Do you have to kind of force some separation there as the boss?
So I don't have to even force it. It just comes with the job, and, you know, it's kind of awkward, and I had to get used to it because they used to show me women on Instagram and stuff. Like, I was their friend. You know, now I come in, they pull up their pants, take off their hats. You know what I mean? It's just weird. It's just different now. But, you know, I respect it and I understand.
They put away their phones. They don't show you they block their Instagram.
Yeah, they don't even show me the Instagram pictures anymore. And they're like, it's just different now.
Is there a balance that you can keep where you're friendly but not friends with a guy you may have to trade, may have to cut? I mean,
yeah, no, there's definitely a balance. You know, a GM told me he golfed with a guy, had dinner over his house, but if there was a trade that he could make for another superstar, he would have drove him to that city himself. Like, that's what it is. Like, you have to do what's best for the organization. So, you know, I've learned this summer from another team, you don't want to say, oh, we're together forever, you're my brother, you know. Just want to be honest and upfront that this could happen. It's the business of basketball, which I've always spoke to him about the business of basketball. I've been traded. I've been amnestied. I've been, you know, signed to max, you know, signed to minimum. Like, I've been through it all. I've seen it all, players at all levels. So I think that bodes well for their confidence in me and their trust in me, like, to understand that it's the business of basketball and it could happen.
That golf drive to the airport, GM, sounds a lot like Danny Ainge. Sounds because I think he'd do that if it meant a trade.
Absolutely. And one thing that I've seen that you know, speaking of Danny, that he's done, he knew the value of his superstars. You know, even if they were aging, even if they were, you know, going through something, he knew what their value was, and you know, he could trade them, get some pieces, and keep growing the organization. Like, I studied that. And I appreciate that, because you look at a Paul Pierce or whoever, he still has a Celtic basketball court at his house. Like, he's not, you know, it's not like he spray painted it over. It's just when he's hung in the rafters, he's hung in the rafters. Like, he comes back for the Hall of Fame speech, he'll mention that. So, you know, the older players, veteran players, they understand the business of basketball also.
I remember when Walter McCarty got the head coaching job at Evansville. He was telling me all the people he knew in the NBA were calling him looking for jobs. Have you experienced that as a GM with people kind of, you know, you have to say no a lot, I would imagine, as a general manager?
Absolutely. You know, we're hiring new positions, and we post all our stuff online. And, you know, unlike some places, they're really available. It's not like we have somebody in house, we're sliding in there. And I've had some ex players say, I'm looking for, you know, the VP of player programs. It's like, okay, all right, we feel that. Then it's like, okay, what does the, you know, head of, you know, analytics and data need to do? Like, they're just applying for everything. And I understand, you know, they want to be in it. But as long as they have the qualifications, you have a shot with me. Like, I'm interviewing everybody.
Were you a Seinfeld guy coming up?
No.
There's a Seinfeld scene where George Costanza says, well, I think I'll apply for the color commentary gig, and Jerry says, well, I think they give that to ex-players. George says, it's not really fair. It's sort of like that. So, you know, well, I don't have analytics experience, but it doesn't matter. I still want that job.
What do I need to do? I was more of a Curb fan, but
okay, fair enough. Wait, how are you a Curb fan and not a, how is that mutually exclusive?
I don't know, HBO, you know.
Yes, yeah. a little more power behind that Curb enthusiasm. Before I let you go, dealing with agents, how has that been for you?
It's been different. You know, when they have a player that they really trying to place, you know, you hear from them every single day, hard, can we do this, can we do that? You know, then they disappear if their player's not happy, they come to you. But, you know, I was with David Falk for over 20 years, so he you know, taught me many lessons over the business of basketball and how agents react with ownership and general managers and coaches. But, you know, it's a task. It's a task. And I understand, too, they're doing what they need to do for their client. They're fighting for their client. So I understand that, too.
Do you delegate in your office? Do you say, look, I can't take all these agent calls. You know, I gotta have you guys handle, like, when it gets to a certain level, bring it to me? Or do you want all the information up front?
So at the beginning, I was doing everything, like every owner's deck, every call, like just to be like, okay, this is me. This is my, you know, ship that I'm running. But now, yeah, I delegate and elevate, like, all right, just bubble it up when it's time to bubble it up, because I'm so busy with everything else. But yeah, absolutely. And if you have a prior relationship that's strong, we might get some stronger intel. We might get some information that I probably may not have gotten with our new relationship.
China trip, I've found business guys love it. Basketball guys, not so much.
Yeah, our group was very energized. I thought they'd be sluggish and walking around and, you know, let's get out of here. But, you know, it led with Joel. You know, Joel was energetic. Ben, he had something with some of his endorsements. So they actually had a lot of energy and was excited. And I'd ask them, and I tried to keep an even tone, like, how's it going? And they're like, no, we're good. So actually the business side kind of suffered. I've heard more complaints from the business side and business ops than the players.
Was Elton Brand the player big in China?
Yeah, I did this one thing called the glass cleaner when I was dressed in like some khakis and a tight button up, and I was like washing windows. And it was an ad that went pretty well in Asia for Nike back in the day. So,
I hope you got some good money out of that.
Oh yeah, of course, of course.
Do you ever wish that, like, I mean, that market's opened up now, man. Like, that's, I mean, you see guys every summer take a Asia tour to sell their sneakers. Do you ever wish that was around when you were coming up?
Yeah, it was bubbling. It was bubbling when I you know,
that was right around
up.
The Yao period when you came into the league.
Yeah. I was there a few years before Yao, so I've seen it. I've seen it mature. I've seen it grow. But I've seen a lot of guys. I'm like, this thing's gonna get oversaturated. Like, I know they have 1.6 billion people, but we're just sending guys that, you know, like the 12th man on the team is going over for a tour. It's just like, knock it off. But it's a great business opportunity, and they love basketball. Like, I'm there, and they're like, congratulations on the GM job. You know what I mean? Like, they follow it. Like, they know what's going on.
It's always amazing that more talent still hasn't come over there as consistently as it did from Europe. That always struck me, because they love it and they play it a lot. And maybe it's just I've heard individual coaching needs to be a little bit different over there. I mean, that's what I get from some of the coaches of players that come over here.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing too, the coaching. But they're trying to grow it. They're spending resources to grow it. And I still think there's time for some talent to come out of that region for sure.
Elton, always appreciate your time, man. Congrats on the new gig, and best of luck this season with Philly.
Thanks, Chris.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Gary Washburn and Elton Brand for joining the show. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.